As Bill mentioned, I'm the executive director of Tech Mission, and I just want to tell you a little bit about how God called myself and Bill to this ministry, and tell you a little bit of my own story, and Bill's going to share some of his story, and why, you know, God has really given us a heart for this type of ministry. This is something that's very personal to me. It's also very personal to Bill, and he'll share some of his story. I grew up in inner city, part of Kansas City. It was poor and working class neighborhood where it was mixed racially. For those of you who are familiar with the artist Eminem, you kind of think of my background as fairly similar to that, coming from inner city Midwest. And you know, different low-income neighborhoods will experience different types of trauma. And you know, for some neighborhoods, the big issue is drugs or gangs or violence. In my neighborhood, the big issue, the big trauma was around sexual trauma. And whenever I was 4 years old, I became fully sexually aware basically was fully sexualized at that age. And by the time, in my neighborhood, by the time I was in the second grade, I felt like I was an outsider in my neighborhood because I was still a virgin. And, you know, whenever you're in an environment like that, where sex is everywhere, pornography is everywhere, it does something to just change how you view the world. I just thought that was the norm at the time. And being in an environment like that, you know, whenever a whole community gets sick, that can be traumatizing for everyone growing up in that community. So that was one part of my life. The other part of my life is I was the son of a Baptist preacher. My dad was a Baptist preacher in a black storefront church in the inner city. And like many preachers' kids, I kind of went through a rebellious phase as a teenager. And whenever I was 17, my girlfriend got pregnant. And that was really the big wake-up call for me because she ended up having a miscarriage. And I took on all the guilt from that experience. And, you know, I heard, don't have sex before you get married. And I took on all the guilt of everything that happened there. So I decided, you know, I can't make mistakes in life. And from then on, I basically became a perfectionist and started performing. And ended up going to school at MIT because I was so driven, you know, never to make a mistake. And I went to school at MIT, and I was aspiring to be, you know, the next Bill Gates and all this. And, you know, it was a little bit before the big dot-com boom. But what happened to me there is essentially all of the trauma from my background eventually caught up to me, and God broke me. And I remember during the second year that I was there at MIT, my life was so miserable. Everything looked great on the outside, but my life was so miserable that I said a prayer to God. I said, God, you need to either help me or to kill me because I can't go on living like this. And essentially what had happened was just the trauma from the experiences that I had growing up basically just came to the front, and God did heal me. God, you know, miraculously brought me through a lot of healing. I went through, you know, 9 years of counseling and group therapy and different things like that, and saw a lot of transformation in my own life, and saw a lot of miracles happen in my own life. And, you know, I realized that God wasn't really calling me to be the next Bill Gates. You know, there's only one Bill Gates, and I had more of a heart for justice, a heart for people, but I had these tech skills, so I was trying to figure out, what do I do with these tech skills? And that's whenever I came here to Bruce Wall Ministries and co-founded the Prep Computer Center, teaching computer classes here in the neighborhood to help address the digital divide, which is the gap between those who have access to computers and training with computers and those without. And we saw God really moving through this program here. We had hundreds of students. Over the time I was there, we had over 1,000 students take the classes. And this website that you saw here, that was actually done by one of our former students, Francois, who's back there, actually was one of our first students, and now he's on staff with Tech Mission. And but what we saw is with this association, it continued to grow. God continued to bless us, and we started up an association of computer centers where it grew to have over 500 computer centers from across the country that last year served over 50,000 people, providing them with free computer classes, free internet access, and things along those lines. So God got us involved in these computer centers, but you know, the tagline for these computer centers is computer skills to make a living, a spiritual foundation to make a life. And we realize that as we're trying to address the digital divide, we aren't doing a whole lot for folks if we take a family that didn't have a computer, and all of a sudden they have a computer, and then the dad's addicted to porn, the mom's having online affairs, and the kid's being exposed to online perpetrators. I wouldn't call that so much of progress. And what we're really trying to do is not just address the digital divide, but get people across the digital divide safely. And that's the reason why we decided that we needed to start up the Safe Families program. And I started to realize also at that point that, you know, God was actually planning to use some of my own experience, some of my own trauma of growing up in community where the whole community was sexualized, to give me vision for a Safe Families program. And Bill has had some experiences that have given him a passion for this type of thing. And you know, at the time whenever I was growing up, my neighborhood was more the exception to the rule. You know, it wasn't like everyone at that point in the second grade felt like they were an outsider because they weren't having sex. But now that type of thing is becoming much more common. And you know, essentially what's happened is that the walls have been broken down. The walls to the family, the walls to the church have been broken down. That's what I want to talk about a little bit. And I'm going to, you know, I'm a third generation minister, I guess. I don't even know whether I would call myself a minister, but I'm going to do a little bit of preaching here for you. So, but I'd like to just start off with a prayer. So God, we just come to you, and we know that you care passionately about this, God. We know that you've called us to a ministry, God. And we know that with the folks here, God, that you have called them to take online safety, to take pornography recovery seriously, God. And I just pray that you would be showing us what it is that you're calling us to. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So just to talk a little bit about, you know, Bill covered a lot of the stats for youth. There's also some significant effects of what pornography has done to families in terms of having the walls broken down with families. Probably the most significant stat that I've seen is there's a recent survey that was done that showed the internet was a significant factor in 2 out of 3 divorces. And you might ask, why is it that significant of a factor? And part of the reason why is for young men, 70% of men are using pornography monthly, and at least 10% are admitting to sexual addiction. And you know, if 10% are admitting to it, there's a lot larger percentage of people who are actually addicted. I mean, it's not just a problem with men. 28% of those who admit addiction are women, and 1 out of 6 women deals with an addiction to porn. And even among Christians, 38% of Christian women have said that they view porn. And 47% of families say that porn is a problem in their family. So, you know, what's happening is there's been this, you know, morality creep, and to where now, you know, on websites, Bill was telling me about a website that he read about somewhere where it's a marriage hookup website. So it's for married people to hook up with other married people, and their tagline is, when monogamy becomes monotony. And their whole thing that they're trying to address is promoting things along those lines. So the walls of the family have been broken down. The walls of the church have been broken down. This isn't something where we just point the finger at them. This is something where the problem is with us. You know, if you look at what's happening with pornography in the church now, and you look at a group like Promise Keepers, and these are men who've, you know, made promises saying that they're going to be upright men and, you know, faithful and have integrity. Among Promise Keepers attendees, 50% had viewed pornography just the week before. With pastors, over 50% of evangelical pastors have admit to using pornography in the past year. And what's happened with this morality creep is things that used to no longer be acceptable have become acceptable, to where even among born-again Christians, 29% are saying that viewing sexually explicit material is okay. And, you know, the reality is that pastors are starting to say, you know, the majority of pastors are saying this is the most significant sexual issue that's happening in our church right now. So with that, I kind of want to go a little bit into preaching mode. And for those of you who are familiar with the story of Nehemiah, Nehemiah was a prophet who God had called to rebuild the walls of the city. And in many ways, that's what's happened to the situation that we're in now. Just like in Nehemiah's time, the walls of Jerusalem had been broken down, and God had called him to help rebuild those walls. So I'm just going to read a passage. passage from Nehemiah 2. If anyone has any Bibles, you can pull those out. If not, you can just look on the screen. By night I went out through the valley gate toward the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through. So I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because I had not yet said anything to the Jews or priests or nobles or officials or any of the others who would be doing the work. And the next part of the passage says, Then I said to them, You see the trouble that we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, Let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. And I feel like with what's happened in the internet is we've seen the walls being broken down. We've seen the walls broken down into our families. We've seen the walls broken down into our church. And that's had a significant impact. And part of what we're trying to do, you know, everyone who's here, we're a part of a ministry of rebuilding the walls in our families, rebuilding the walls in our churches, rebuilding the walls in our own lives. And I feel like this is something that God's called all of us here to do. And God not only called us, but what happened in Nehemiah's situation was the king had actually appointed him to rebuild the wall and gave him the resources. And here in Safe Families, we actually have money from the Department of Justice to do this program. Now, all the stuff that we do for pastors or any faith-related content, we only use private grants for, and we make sure we separate out everything. But for the parents' content and for a lot of the other materials, we've gotten funding from the government to help pull these materials together. So we've been giving both, you know, the blessing of God and the blessing of the king. So our goal here is to give you some tools to help rebuild the wall in your church. And, you know, one way of viewing this is, you know, the pornography industry is a lot like the tobacco industry. And, you know, the tobacco industry, I think, something people are aware of the ways that the tobacco industry has hurt people. And, you know, what the industry does is it hooks kids early. And, you know, you had the people attacking Joe Camel for trying to get kids to smoke at an early age. There's also the issue of secondhand smut, just like the issue of secondhand smoke. And it used to be, you know, there's a time whenever, you know, Bill was telling me about, you know, on the tee, where you'd just be on the tee. You aren't supposed to smoke on the tee, but everyone on the tee's smoking. And it used to be everyone smoked everywhere, and it was cool to smoke. Now that's significantly shifted. And we need to see the same type of shift happen with smut, where it's not like you're, you know, everywhere you go, you're being exposed to the secondhand smut. And, you know, part of the issue, you know, is just acknowledging that pornography is damaging. And, you know, as much as people use pornography, I've never met a person who said, you know, I'm proud of using pornography. There's no one that talks about their porn habit and says, well, I really want to use more pornography because I don't think I'm using enough. So I don't think there's anyone, as much as people may say it's not damaging, I think that there's very few people that are going to say it's a good thing. And I think that we need to make a shift, that pornography, you know, what's happening in our society is actually becoming cool, like cigarette smoking was cool, and we need to make this shift so that pornography is not cool, it's something that's for perverts. And, you know, secondhand smut needs to be treated like secondhand smoke. And we should be able to keep pornography and other issues out of our home. You know, the sanctity of the home. Right now, like, imagine if the tobacco industry required that you had a cigarette vending machine in your home. Or imagine if the alcohol industry required that you had a fully stocked bar that, you know, anytime your child wanted a Budweiser, they could just open up the door and they could get one. That's the way it is with the internet. Every family that has a computer in their home, they have the largest library of pornography in the world available to them. But the things aren't in place yet to protect your home. You should be able to say, I don't want this in my home, but right now, that's not possible. And you should require age verification. You know, it's crazy that all, you know, if a kid had to buy cigarettes and all they had to do is just say, yes, I'm 18, and then it was okay, that would be crazy. You'd have all these, you know, kids 5, 6 years old buying cigarettes, buying alcohol, but we don't allow that. But we do allow that on the internet. So there hasn't really been a public outcry, and part of what we're hoping to do in the next year, you know, and distributing the software to 100,000 people, that's our goal. We're hoping to distribute some of these materials that we've done to thousands of churches. Our goal is to help raise the awareness so that there is a public outcry. We've already covered, you know, the stats around youth, but just to acknowledge that that's also a major part of this, with both youth and online perpetrators. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill, and he's going to talk about some of the adult industry and some of the stats around that.
We're using both.
Okay. So we're a high-tech group.
Still recording?
We got three microphones for two people.
We good?
All right, thanks, Andrew. The adult industry, these are some amazing statistics. Last year, in the United States alone, $12.6 billion of revenue. That is more than the combined revenue of NBC, ABC, and CBS. That is more than the combined revenue of the NFL, the National Basketball Association, and Major League Baseball. That's a big industry. It is now the number of rentals in just 1 year, a billion, just short of a billion rentals of X-rated videos. I don't understand the number 1 billion. Hotel viewership. Now, you know, you go to a hotel and you have those on-demand movies that you pay for. Most of what is rented is pornography. There was a youth workers conference at a hotel some time ago, and the staff of that hotel said that weekend they had more porn rentals than they'd ever had. 3.1 million pornographic websites, unique visitors, 45 million. I think that's monthly, I'm not sure. I think that's monthly. In your wonderful pamphlet, you have an article from somebody that I've developed an email relationship. Her name is Shelley Lubin. And I'm not sure where, oh yeah, it's right here. She has a wonderful article on the truth behind porn. She describes what it's like to actually be one of the people that does this. She's a former porn actress and prostitute who God has redeemed miraculously and given a new life. She's got a wonderful website with lots of great resources. She's good people, and she's written this article. It's a painful read, but I think it's important for us to recognize what this is doing to the people who are actually involved in making this possible. In my humble opinion, internet porn is what is called the perfect drug delivery system. It is perfect because of the three A's. Number one, it is totally accessible. You no longer have to go to that seedy store in that part of town and ask for something that you're too embarrassed to admit. You can just wait till everybody's asleep and there it is. It is also affordable. There's enough free porn on there to keep you busy for a whole long time. And finally, it's anonymous. What other addiction's got those three things going for it? Costs you nothing, you can get it anytime, and no one needs to know you're doing it. That's a perfect drug delivery system. Let's talk about its effects on users. This is an article I saw on Triple X Church's website. I'm going to be very quick with it. It's just someone who wrote this, and the title was, Porn Has Completely Destroyed Me. I was ashamed, and I do not like what now stimulates me, but the internet, with all its quick fix, crack-like vices, has made me extraordinarily intolerant. Are you a Tufts or Harvard grad and a great conversationalist? Not important. Do you have a quirky sense of humor and a knack for Asian fusion cuisine? Don't care. Would you like to discuss the subtext meaning of that painting in the MFA? Kindly be gorgeous or turn into antimatter. I am ruined. I am dead on the inside, ashamed and embarrassed of what stimulates me. I am irrevocably changed for the worse. For all practical purposes, porn has destroyed me. And this is writing to young women. Pull your head out of the sand and be advised. It is spreading like a plague among my gender. If you're female and don't possess Einsteinian caliber, then throw every last dollar you have at your physical appearance. Look good or you're alone. That's sobering. There's a whole generation now that has expected women to look like porn stars, like centerfolds. Porn also perpetuates the legitimacy of violence against women. There's a website I learned about that features the premise that these guys are putting girls, drugging them, and making them fall out of sleep, and then having sex with them. And that's displayed on these websites. Like, this is an okay thing. Oh, it's just fantasy. But clearly that's just a violation. That, well, that's there. This is what people are using. I like to call this the elephant in the pew. And we're trying to ignore it. But enough about statistics. Let me tell you a story. About 11 years ago, I was in this building, possibly in this room, I don't remember, with some service that we were having. And we sang a song that had the words, "I have a living hope, I have a future, God has a plan for me, of this I'm sure." And I said in my mind a phrase that has something to do with the dumb gate. I felt like all the things I knew about God's love, I was the big N/A, not applicable. Somehow I felt that I was the exception clause to all that I knew about God's love. You see, I started a lust affair with pornography way back in college. And it had grown through my marriage, through my entire adulthood. Nothing had worked. I had done things to try to get well, and it had just continued to escalate and escalate and escalate. There were times I felt so bad about it that I would deliberately not take communion, because I knew I couldn't make a commitment to the Lord that I wouldn't sin the next day. I looked at a huge cost. I actually quantified about how much money I actually spent. I don't remember that figure anymore. The amount of time, the loss of sleep, the relational absence, the spiritual compromise, the incredible risks I took. I was a slave. I was a slave. Even when I was victorious over one temptation, I was so depleted, the next one had no problem. So if I won, I lost. And you know, I want to be very honest. It was my fault. I take responsibility. It was my sin. Yeah, sure, I had some things that maybe in my childhood or upbringing contributed. Sure, maybe I had some things in terms of this world giving this input that we talked about the secondhand smoke. Sure, I had the demonic forces working with all they had against me. But I take the responsibility. I chose this. And yet, I didn't know how to get out of it. I remember during that period, I was just thinking, what now? I had tried. I tried counseling. I tried support groups. I tried what I thought was transparency. It was really just commiserating. And for a while, I thought maybe suicide would be the best thing. Maybe this world would be better off without me. Maybe that's... And I'm not talking about the passing kind of, so I kill myself. I'm talking about a rational deciding, well, is this the best course of action? Now, praise God, I didn't go any further than that, and probably the main reason was because of my children. I didn't want to do that to them. But that's where it brought me. And it not only brought me low, but it caused an amazingly devastating experience to my wife, my children, my parents, my sister, my friends, my church. So, I hope I've painted a sobering picture for you. What do? How do you respond when someone's addicted? And for those of you who are in ministry in churches, you need to know what I'm going to share. You need to know this. Let me share with you a little bit about what it's like to be an addict. Let me take you into that world. We addicts have four core beliefs. I believe I'm a bad person, and therefore, if anybody really knew me, you couldn't possibly love me. I also believe, as an addict, my needs are never going to be met if I depend on other people. And finally, I believe that sex is the most important need. I actually believe if I don't act out, I will die. And you think, how could you think that? I don't know, but I did. I know that I did. And you see what an airtight cycle of hopelessness, isolation, and insanity this is? This system of beliefs has no exit ramp. Nothing but the divine reach of the Almighty can get at this. If you want some more information about it, you can take a look at our articles. We have lots of articles about addiction. But you can see this is an awful predicament to be in. And I know this firsthand. The second thing you need to know about addicts is they have the ability to lie. An amazing ability to lie. As part of a rehashing of my recovery, I felt like I needed to address some issues that I had not been addressing, and so recently I did what's called a first step. It's where I wrote some things about where I stood with the addiction. And in it I wrote this. My ability to self-deceive is limitless. I can take clear, overwhelming evidence that points to one conclusion and make a completely contrary assessment. If I act out by any definition, people get hurt. And yet so often in the moment of decision, I cannot remember this. And finally I wrote this. It is beyond my ability to comprehend this, but somehow I totally forgot that my using lust in any way would break my wife's heart. Folks, that's a crazy man. That's insanity. That's deception. So this is who you're dealing with if you're counseling somebody who's addicted to this stuff. This applies to all kinds of sexual addiction, particularly porn addiction. So what do we do? Well, there are some things that you can do. And I want to say right now that the church can have an amazing impact on helping someone back to the road of recovery. This church did that for me. Pastor Bruce and Pastor Craig, I count as two of the key people that helped keep me and get me back on the track, and I will never be able to pay that incredible debt of gratitude. It is not lost on me that I'm here sharing this story 11 years after. My church helped save my life. And I want that on the web. So your church can really make a difference. We have 7 steps for you. We're kind of big on steps, aren't we? And the first four are kind of like immediate ones that you kind of do quickly. And the last three are three things that sort of have to be all done, not in any particular order. They need to all be done at the same time. So let me move on. Immediate response. This is something that is really important. Oh, and the good news is, of course, it's in your manual. So if you forget, and if you forget that, it's on the CD, and it's also on the website. We got you covered. So the first thing is you want to designate point person for the addict. People in your church who are going to be responsible. Yeah, I was on suicide watch. I needed a couple people to watch me. You also need someone to be on a point person for the spouse. Who's going to be called? How you doing? How's it going? Where are you at? Point person on the children. And something I realized later is a point person for the parents or other family members who may be involved in this. So have people who are going to be involved in making sure each of these people are okay. Consider the divestment of ministry responsibilities. For me, it was important that I step away from my role as a music minister for a season. And in retrospect, as talking with one of the pastors, I probably should have taken a longer leave than I did. For some people who are struggling with this, it is not a good idea to have the responsibility of ministry as well as the challenge of recovery. It's just not a good thing. And sometimes you can use the ministry as an excuse to not deal with your stuff. There's also a concern of the reputation and the church being a reproach. So consider that, depending on the severity and the situation and the seniority of the ministry position. This is a hard one, but this is real important. If physical boundaries were crossed, and I'll be blunt, that includes oral and genital sex, STD testing is mandatory. I remember with somebody that I was in a group with, he refused to do it. He was too scared. He put himself at risk. He put his wife at risk. It just takes one time. So that's a very hard thing to do, but it needs to be done if the physical boundary is crossed. Physical support for the children. One of our times that we needed to actually call our kids' teachers and tell them the family's going through this. And some of the teachers were good friends, and we told them exactly what was happening. But we wanted to say, you know, our child is maybe experiencing some additional stress, because we didn't tell them what was going on, but they know that mommy and daddy are mad. They know that there's something, they know trauma. They got it. They may assume it's their fault, but they know something's wrong. So get the support for the kids. And there may be other emergency measures that are needed. Relocation, if it's really severe and there's a break in the marriage. Legal, in case some certain boundaries were crossed. And financial support may be necessary too. I had a friend who spent more than $10,000 in phone sex. That was 10 years ago. Young single man. He didn't have $10,000. All this could be to be taken with compassion and respect for privacy, not just for the sake of the addict, but the whole family, but with aware that the addict cannot be trusted to be completely honest. There's an expression that I have come to hate. How can you tell an addict is lying? His lips are moving. That's hard, but what's hard about it is it resonates. Something we feel is very important is a church-based accountability partner. They should be of the same gender. They should be somebody who is experiencing victory, not easily conned. So it's great if it's a recovering addict, because they know the game. Someone who can keep confidence, because that's essential. There are things I know about other people I will die never having told. I'm committed to that. You need to be available for a daily check-in by phone or email, and face-to-face, well, once or twice a month, and to be on call for those 2 a.m. emergency calls. You need somebody who is not so nice, who will be willing to ask those hard questions, and finally, someone who will monitor internet usage, and I'll get to that in a sec. So what we have here is our sample accountability questions. We've got these from a variety of sources, and we made up a couple of our own. Most of these I got from somebody I've met since I've been doing this, named Tom Buford, who's a former recovering addict. He's got a wonderful website. Check it out, please. Firesofdarkness.com. And he gave us permission to use these accountability questions. He was very happy to do this. Something that's kind of interesting is there's a question 3. Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired are the trigger points for an addict. When any of those 4 things are in operation, the risk is increased. And so me as an addict, I have to be very careful when those factors are in activity. I've been doing something like these questions with somebody every weekday for 10 years. That's how seriously it is for me. I talked to him Tuesday. I missed him the last 2 days, but we have been doing that for 10 years. And he's been asking me some questions just like these. And I believe on page 16, we have more questions. We have more websites that have even more questions if you want. Swindoll has a bunch. There's one from one of the 12-step groups. So if you don't like these, or you want to mix and match, go ahead. But if you know someone who's an addict, get them to make these accountability questions with somebody that they are going to be accountable to. Accountability software is a program that runs in the background of your computer that basically is a big fat tattletale. I have one running right now on this computer. I have another one on my computer at work. I am playing. It reports on what you're doing, when you're doing it, all the time. And you can't even uninstall it without your person who's monitoring it finding out, this was installed at such and such a time. And what it does, it doesn't stop you from doing anything. Go ahead. But somebody's going to know. By the way, filters are for children, accountability software is for parents, for adults. That's kind of our general rule. Kids, they don't need to have the experimentation. But we need to learn discipline and control. And if you need a filter, so be it. But initially, that's what we recommend. The one I use is Covenant Eyes. It's $7 a month. It's available for, the pricing available for households, for ministries, for businesses. So for example, if a church had 10 computers all networked, they could get a reduced price for the whole church. It regularly sends a list of all websites visited to the selected recipients. And you can say, I want you to send it to so-and-so, and to so-and-so, and to so-and-so. And every week, so-and-so will get an email list of everywhere I looked. Pretty cool, huh? I was too arrogant to put one on for a long time. I've recently stopped being so arrogant. I have it. Let me show you what it does. This is an actual report that I got from one of the people who's accountable to me for a period of time. And I know you can't read it, but what it does is it shows a detailed log and times and a score of all the questionable websites that this person went to. Now, it turns out these were false positives, and that's okay. That happens. But these are ones that I thought, this might not be good. And what's really cool is then it goes into the daily logs, and you notice that thing in a different color? That would be a questionable website. So if I did see Playboy.com in there, there are not a lot of ministry excuses for using that. I would probably say, so what was up with that? And I would have the time, and there'd be no deniability. There's another program called X3 Watch. And this is free, which is a pretty good price. And another cool thing about this is it works for Macintoshes. This is a ministry of Triple X Church. God bless them. They don't know how they're giving it out for free, but they're doing it. And so that's available on their website. It's a very nice program too. And then we got a few more. These are three other ones that we have. And they're listed, I'm sorry, I didn't get the page number written. Is it 10? Thank you. On page 10. So if you want something a little more expensive and possibly a little more robust, you feel free to do these. But we advise anybody who's ever struggled with internet pornography to do this. The next suggestion we have is to adopt what we're calling a media sobriety covenant. On page 17 and 18, that's in the manual. And this is an agreement that all adults, we're suggesting, make. And the commitment to these things. We're calling media sobriety appropriate use of all forms of media, whether it's games or movies or internet use or television. Commitment to protect children, especially from secondhand smut, to get educated, for appropriate communication, to avoid online affairs. Andrew mentioned that site. And to also commitment to recovery for those who need it, and to support those who are in recovery for those who need it. So we would suggest that everyone adopt this. But we also have one for those who are particularly in need of recovery. And these are the 8 commitments that we strongly recommend. To have an accountability partner, you just heard about that. Software, heard about that. To be part of recovery groups, we're going to talk about that in a minute. To close entry points. So if your vulnerability is that credit card gets destroyed. If it's that membership at that video store, that goes. If it's a certain subscription to a magazine, that gets tight, that gets killed. Wherever the entry point is. To learn about recovery, like we're doing now, to be transparent with the spouse, to end any online affairs, any kind of relationship where you would be not talking that way face to face, it's inappropriate online. And finally, to avoid hiding. So we suggest that anybody who's looking for recovery, who comes to you, adopt these 3 things, and then one more thing, give them this. Give it to them. There are lots of items here that are covered. So we recommend that they look through some of the items here. And I forgot to put a link on here, so give me a sec. Let's go back to our webpage. I'm going to show you some of the cool things we have for grown-ups. See, is my mouse acting up? Get over there.
Thank you.
So under resources, we have, under the parents thing, that'll stop in a minute, and I apologize for that. These same, very same steps, and more information about how you can do that. And we have recovery tools for anybody who's in need of recovery. We have the same resources you saw, but this time we have things on recovery from sex addiction. Lots of recommended books, lots of recommended links, organizations that are working on this, presentations that will help you, and media that will help you. Please take a look at all those things. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to show you all of them right now. but I will show you some things later in a bit. Get my mouse back over here. Oops, let's close that. Sorry about that. This dual monitor thing is brand new to me. That's better. Okay. Now, those four things, they can be done pretty quickly. You can take those urgent steps. You can get the accountability partner. You can get the point people. You can get the other resources that we mentioned. You can get that done, and you should do that immediately if you're in leadership helping someone. These next five things take a little bit of time. They're not steps as in five after six, six after five, and seven after six. These three things all need to be done. First one is support for the family. So much of the energy can be focused on the addict, but the family experiences an amazing amount of trauma. For children, for parents of children, we could give them the same strategies you heard an hour ago on online safety. Encourage the parents to take it very seriously, because you can see where it has led adults who've started with this habit. And if it's possible, get your child to meet with somebody who's actually in recovery. It occurred to me later that there needs to be support of parents for adults, like my parents needed. And some of the things that they would need would be resources like information. Because most people are not experts on this until it crashes into their lives. So I know my parents would say that one of the things they just didn't understand, how can this be? What is this? And at that point, we didn't know, all of us didn't know anything of what we know now. But to provide those family members with the information about what I just shared about what the addict goes through for some of those books. What I am going to show you is what a parent shouldn't do. This is from a wonderful, wonderful video. I love this one. Called Beating the Bunny. I think you can probably guess what the bunny might be. Some of you are too innocent to know, but that's okay. And it's a humorous but very edgy and very interesting video. I'm going to play a little clip of a young man, he's about 18 or so, who's struggling with this issue and his mom and dad's failure to meet this.
Spoilers for it.
Okay.
Can anybody say ouch? It's a pretty amazing, the whole video is pretty amazing. I recommend it. There needs to be support for the spouse. There aren't words to describe what it is like to have this experience. We're in Buttrey Hall, and Dan Buttrey described it as a Mack truck driving through a stained glass window. The window might get repaired, but it will never be the same. I've become acquainted with a beautiful sister named Robin who has a website called Love Your Sister. It's a support group. Jamal, can you turn that down? That's for spouses of people. It's just an affirming website for women. And she wrote this letter and put it on one of the websites, blazinggrace.org, which I'll talk about later. And I really need those of you who are in ministry to hear this. So I am going to read it because it's very important. She's in the process of trying to figure out what to do because her husband is in a place of not wanting to get well. And this is the clear and present danger of the household. I first sought help from a pastor during one of our separations. He encouraged me to just keep praying. I called a second pastor who said most of the time these issues are related from a man's lack of relationship with his father. He promised to make an appointment but never returned my calls. I tried a third pastor who said, men need lots of boosts to their ego, lots of strokes. That's just the way we're made. I went away feeling he agreed with my husband, that I couldn't measure up to the task of satisfying my husband's needs. His help from the part I was playing in creating the problems of the marriage. Almost as a last-ditch effort, we spoke to a new pastor at our church. 3 days later, my husband left again, and I found myself back in this office where I confessed I thought my husband was struggling with porn. He told me, you can probably expect to see your husband's life go downhill now. He will most likely give in to the sinful lifestyle which he's become involved in. There were no offers of help or suggestions for seeking help for the restoration of my marriage. This is one of the most hurtful things I experienced in seeking a solution. I believe someone would recognize my husband's need for help and come alongside us in the church and provide the support we need, but I was very disappointed to find the church was neither prepared nor ready to meet this challenge. Second ouch. 4 there are other resources out there for spouses. These are three that I know about. Healing Journey is a wonderful website by a woman named Marsha Means, who's a therapist and also an ex-wife of a sex addict. An Affair of the Mind is an amazing book written by Laurie Hall. It was the first book that I know of that was written from the spouse's point of view. An amazing book. It's a mandatory read if you're ever dealing with a family in this situation. And the final resource is a 12-step group called S-Anon, which is analogous to Al-Anon. It's a support group for people who are connected relationally, who are close to sex addicts. Unfortunately, there are very few resources for husbands of sex addicts yet. Very few. There are a few resources for women sex addicts, but very few for their husbands. A peer support group is also extremely important. Now I'm talking about the addict's needs. There are three sources I'm going to mention here. These are peer-to-peer. The first one is the 12-step group. And in your handout, let's see if I can find it. Thanks, Robert. Marsha Means, who I mentioned on A Woman's Healing Journey, has written the best letter I have seen addressing Christian concerns about 12-step groups. I know that there's been some controversy in the Christian community because they're not explicitly Christian, but she addresses the concerns, and it's the best letter I've seen. So I asked her for permission to copy it. She gave it to me. It's in your handouts. And for me, God could have chosen any way to get me healed, but that was the primary vehicle. That was the one he used. I'm still part of a 12-step group, and it's been very critical in my life. Another resource, It's a program called Living Waters. And where are the, do we have them in the brochures? I mean the handouts? We have, oh, they're coming. We'll be handing out pamphlets from them. Living Waters is an amazing biblically based discipleship ministry that takes people who are relationally and sexually broken, and frankly that's everybody, and is really applying the principles of Christianity, the biblical principles to it. I've gone through it. A lot of the folks that I'm close to have gone through it. I recently got a letter from a black minister friend of mine. I asked him to share what his experience when he was in Living Waters was like, and he said something to this effect. I was impressed with the honesty of the leadership team and noted that I have never seen anything like this in the black community, especially in our churches. I didn't realize that anything like this existed. I don't recall ever hearing a black minister confess to the level that I heard our Caucasian brothers do in Living Waters. Now I'm beginning to wonder what we are missing by not practicing the same philosophy of honesty. As a middle-aged black man, I am forever changed. And I contribute it to my Living Waters experience, my spiritual care team, and support of my congregation. We really want to be helping to let people of color, people in the urban community, know about this resource. It is an amazing resource, so we want to share that with you. So we have pamphlets that we are giving out about that. And then finally, online groups. There are a couple of groups that I know of that are online. One that I actually used when I felt like I needed something else besides what I had, calling Setting Captives Free. What a great name, huh? And it's basically a 30 to 60 day program. We have a Bible study every day dealing with a particular type of addiction. There's one for sex addiction, there's one for alcohol, one for drugs, for gambling, for food, just all the various addictions. They have a special program and they match you up with a mentor, somebody who's already been through the program and who evaluates your answers and helps you through it. And then the final thing is professional counseling. On page 22 and also in your handout, we have some resources there. In the handout, we have local counseling resources, and in the page 22, we have national ones. I asked one of my other friends in this ministry, this area, Jason Graves, who's a therapist, Christian therapist, what are the questions you need to ask when you're trying to find a Christian counselor? Jamal, I'm going to run out of time, just to let you know. And so he gave me the questions that are in the manual on page 22. So I thank him for that. One of the other things that Jason said is very important. A therapist should have a strong exit strategy. In other words, a therapist's goal should be to get themselves out of a job and help you be restored to the community. Some of the resources, we have the national ones in our manual. There's also something that Jason runs, which are telephonic recovery groups. So folks phone in and conference calls and basically have a group. On the phone. And then finally, in severe cases, there may be a need for residential experience. One of them that we know about is something that Steve Gallagher runs called Pure Life Ministries. It's in, I believe, either Tennessee or Kentucky. And it's an amazing residential program where people are able to just get away from everything and get clean. So just to close, I'm going to skip this clip right now because I'm running out of time. I just want to share with you a word of hope. I do. Okay, good enough. You ready? This is a clip.
Why don't you skip this clip, pastors?
Yep, okay. So I'm going to move on into... Oops, I didn't mean to hit that. So I'm going to move into strategies for church-wide. Okay? First of all, meet with your leadership team. This is very important because you all need accountability as a leadership team. I've mentioned that parsonage.org is focused on the family's website for pastors. Parsonage.com has a link to pornography. Is that evil or what? So meet with your leadership team. I'm sorry, I went too fast. So let me slow down. Oops, not going right. Sorry about that, folks. Share with them the significance of the issues, and you can share with them the resources that I've shared with you today. Develop a strategy for your church. Begin with a men's group. Make copies of this manual for them. We have here, and you have in your packets, I believe, a DVD. This is from Steve Gallagher, who I mentioned. He's put this DVD out, and he's given us permission to give it to you for free. Is it in the packet? It is.
Yes.
It's called A Call to Freedom. It's a message he preached at a large urban church in Memphis. And it's a wonderful sermon on the need for repentance in terms of becoming free from addiction. It's in your packet. Yours truly has done a webcast on temptation, and I will get that URL out in a few minutes. I don't have that right now. So if you want practical strategies about that, that's on our website. Distribute flyers that we're going to be having soon about safe families. Get people aware and talking about it. Look at the covenant that we mentioned. Give them links to the accountability software. And then talk about other steps the church is going to take. Start accountability groups. These are groups we recommend meet for 6 to 12 weeks, a couple hours a week, using some of the books that we're suggesting. And some of the books we have, I'm going to mention in a minute, in your package and your handouts, and also some in page 22 and 23, is something from a group called Blazing Grace. Mike Janon is an amazing man who's been recovering, and he has something called Strength in Numbers. We want to share that with you. It's yours to use on how to do an accountability group. There's also something called the Recovery Kit, which comes from Rick Warren's church. Celebrate Recovery is their ministry to addiction recovery. And they have a kit available as well. Some of the books we recommend, they're on our website. Every Man's Battle, Secret Men's Wars, and At the Altar of Sexual Adultery, written by Steve Gallagher, who I mentioned before. We recommend you could read through those books as a group together. I'm moving quickly, so I apologize for that. Focus on Safe Family Initiative. On a Safe Family Initiative for your whole church. Through your Sunday school, you could talk to your children about the safety and the needs that they have to be careful. Your youth group, you could bring this up. Do it with the women's group, because women often have the same issue. Information table with flyers and materials and software distributions. And you can order CDs from us at $1, which is just the cost it takes us basically to make it. Finally, special events. Just Lust is an amazing series from an organization called creativepastors.com. It has everything you need to put on a series about the issue of lust. DVDs, it's got the sermons on video and in text with the outlines. And so you can use them, you can write them, you can rewrite them for yourself, or you can watch them as a congregation. Media kits, all the posters, flyers, bulletins, everything you need. It's all here. There's in your packet on page 26 and following a sermon outline from Focus on the Family about pornography. Don't know where to start? There you go. You could show Call to Freedom at a special service. You could adapt my temptation talk if you wanted to give a message on how to overcome temptation. And there's the link there. Invite special speakers to come and share. And finally, show the Beat and the Bunny video to your youth group. It'll open up discussion. And we hope to have more stuff for you. 44% of churchgoers want their pastors to talk more about sex and sexual issues. Almost half. That was last year. Finally, please spread the word. Tell people about this workshop. Anybody that you think could benefit from this, please let them know about it. Let them know that they're free to use it, to copy all these materials, just like we've shared. Distribute the flyers and copy the CDs. We want to help you help others. So feel free to do that. Copy and email the manual to anybody who might want to use it. Let's rebuild the wall together. In closing, just for my story, I am being restored. I'm not finished. It's not over. It's a long process. I have not had a perfect recovery. I've had some ups. I've had some downs. I've had some good times and I've had some struggles. But I am nowhere near what I used to be. And I'm no longer a slave. And every morning I wake up with a day where I didn't act ridiculous. I know God is with me. I cannot be an atheist. It's just not an option for me. Because I am living proof that God exists. But I couldn't have done this without the help of my family, my parents, my sister, my own children, and especially, God bless her, my wife. Couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it with deep friends who I'm still in contact with on a regular basis. I couldn't have done it with the external resources, some of which I mentioned, and I couldn't have done it without this church. It wouldn't have happened. So I encourage you to help us. Let's help rebuild the wall together. God bless you all tonight. Thanks.
I'd like to just, if people have some questions, I know there's a lot of people who may have different needs, and if you have some quick questions for Bill, to go ahead and have those now, and whatever you can do to help spread the word, too. So does anyone have any questions?
feel free to stick around. If you have any questions, you can come find me and Bill.
Yes.
We would like to follow up with some men's groups, and we also, this workshop will be available online. You can play the whole thing available online. We're hoping if all this is taken, it's pretty easy to do. So that's something that we can provide too. So if you all are connected in other churches that you think would, you know, want to find out about this, you know, help spread the word, send this to your church, have an email list, and them, we'll have flyers, copy, download from our website, and also you follow Bill.
My card's right here.
And you want to take any copies of these folders, you want to take any copies of those and give them to your